Ladies and gentlemen, we are reaching the 11th hour of the Aspen Security Forum, and I've been asked to tell you that the attendee surveys are now out in the lobby, and if you would stop to fill out a survey on your way out, we'd be deeply grateful. In the words of Jimmy Buffett, Senator John McCain is the son of a sailor. His father, Jack McCain, and his grandfather, Slew McCain, were both four-star U.S. Navy admirals. The senator himself was born at Coco Solo Naval Air Station in the Panama Canal Zone, and his military home of record was Norfolk. Rumor has it that he has in his veins a lot of salt water and maybe a little vinegar. Senator McCain graduated from the Naval Academy in 1958. He subsequently served with great distinction as a naval aviator in Vietnam. When his aircraft was shot down in October 1967, John McCain began nearly 6 years of brutal imprisonment. His courage during that confinement is now legendary. His unflinching leadership, exemplary. For his military service, John McCain was awarded the Silver Star, 2 Legions of Merit, 3 Bronze Stars, and the Distinguished Flying Cross. Following his release from prison in 1973, then Captain McCain was assigned as a legislative liaison to the Congress. Not surprisingly, he decided to take over the place. He was elected to the U.S. House in 1982 and the U.S. Senate in 1986. He is currently chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Brave, blunt, and independent, there can be no doubt that John McCain is passionately committed to America's security. He will be interviewed today by veteran 60 Minutes correspondent Leslie Stahl. Leslie.
Thank you. Just so you know what you're up against, I've taken a poll of everybody here, and the poll is running 200 McCain, 0 Trump.
I want you all to come out to Arizona and register to vote, okay? Could I also thank for the kind introduction and thank you for not mentioning that I lost running for President of the United States. I appreciate that.
Well, I haven't had my chance to talk yet.
I just want to mention, after I lost, I slept like a baby. Sleep 2 hours, wake up and cry. Sleep 2 hours, wake up and cry. Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you, Senator. And thank you, Clark, for another brilliant, brilliant conference, as everybody's pointed out. Well, let's start with the news. Jonathan Pollard. There's talk, there are reports that the administration is okay with him being released now after 30 years. Where do you stand on this?
Could I just say, first of all, it's wonderful to be back here. I am more glad to be here than most any place I can be besides my home state of Arizona. It's beautiful, but more importantly, the level of the dialogue and discussion here, I think, is very helpful, not only to observers, but also to people who are in positions of responsibility and those who will be. So I'm very pleased to be back. Leslie, I know that the way your reputation and the way you conduct interviews, I will probably not have had as much fun since my last interrogation. So thank you.
Thank you for that.
Jonathan Pollard, I think we should release Jonathan Pollard. I think so for a variety of reasons, including it has a lot to do with our relationship with the state of Israel. I think it also has to do with 30 years of confinement. And I think it has a lot to do with the kind of a hopefully a situation where the relations between our country and our citizens can be improved. It's not an easy call. He did betray the United States of America, and that obviously is something we all condemn, including the Israelis. But I think it's time, and he served a punishing 30 years.
Do you think it's a coincidence that this is happening just as this Iran deal comes out and the Israelis are just so livid and emotional about it? Is it done to assuage them?
It may be, and I would regret that if that's the reason. It may be. We live in a pretty cynical world, but I have announced at least 3 or 4 years ago that I was in favor of his release. My view doesn't have anything to do with this, but that certainly is an allegation that may have some substance to it.
There'll be pushback in the Congress.
Yes, I think there will be some, but you know, given our attention spans, how many members of Congress have ever heard the name Jonathan Pollard? Really?
It's a long time.
Yeah, it's been a long time. The issue has not been in the news. Maybe it's because of my own life, but I'm a great believer in redemption, my friends. And I think that Jonathan Pollard has regretted and his what he did. And so...
It's time.
Yeah.
The Iran deal. Well, let's start by you telling us what your greatest concern is about the deal, what your fear is about this.
My greatest concern is that Iran continues unrestrained, and now with $50 or $100 billion to continue their behavior in the Middle East, which is aggressive, which has been to a large degree successful, and they now control 4 countries, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. And they have continued to increase their influence in those countries. I was the 4th of July in Kabul, and we received the news there that the Iranians are now providing arms to the Taliban. They commit acts of terror throughout the region. It's very clear what their mission is. And when we look particularly at a country like Iraq, they are supporting the Shia militias, which we fought against during the surge. We now have Qasem Soleimani, who is basically orchestrating the military efforts of the Iraqi Shiite militias. I would remind you that Qasem Soleimani is the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. In a hearing with General Dunford, who is a nominee for chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he was asked how many copper-tipped IEDs were responsible for, how many American deaths could you attribute to the IEDs? These are copper-tipped that, and the reason why they're so lethal is they go right through armor. They were imported from Iran into Iraq. So this guy's got the blood of at least 500 American Marines and soldiers on his hands. I have no idea how many wounded. Guess what, as part of this deal? The Iranians are going to lift the sanctions on this guy. I mean, some of it is Orwellian. Finally, my other concern is the money, obviously.
Okay,
what they're going to do with the money.
Let's go through that.
Well, yep.
The argument, obviously, is that if this deal is not approved, then one, the sanctions crumble, because our allies and other partners in this want to trade with Iran, and that they will have just a couple of weeks to get the bomb out. There'll be no restriction on what they can do. I mean, everybody agrees that they're bad guys, but what about the slowing down of their nuclear program? Isn't it worth it for that?
Well, first of all, he's consistently cheated, and now we hear that the IAEA and they have some secret deal. My God, the members of Congress are not going to know what the provisions are of a deal between Iran and the IAEA on one of the most important aspects, and that is the inspections and verification of their compliance with this agreement. I mean, that is insanity. The president and his administration, I have to give them credit, they're very good at setting up straw men. For example, if we give defensive weapons to the Ukrainians, who are being slaughtered now by Russians, it will be war with Russia. And this is a straw man. We've only got 2 choices. It's not true. We have lots of choices. If the sanctions are lifted by the Europeans,
right.
By the way, towards Ukraine and in this issue, they're behaving in the best tradition of Neville Chamberlain, then the American sanctions can be strengthened and enforced, and in many aspects, particularly the financial sector, the Europeans will have, if we sanction the Iranian financial system, then the Europeans can do business with Iran or they can do business with us. not both, because we will maintain financial sanctions on Iran. So,
well, what about reducing the time to make a bomb?
If it, quote, reduces the time, that means that you assume that they haven't been going full bore. We believe that they've been doing everything that they can as rapidly as they can.
But you don't think this stops it, is what you're saying?
I believe that without the proper inspection, why 24 days, my friends, after there's an allegation of some activities that may be in violation of the agreement? In 24 days, you can cover up a lot of mischief. Why that? Why was there the relaxation of the sanctions on conventional weapons at the last minute? At the last minute, it all of a sudden, time after time, John Kerry said, this is only about nukes, nothing to do with nukes, that's all. That was his reason for not demanding the release of the four Americans who are being held hostage in Iran. Mm-hmm. So now we find out right at the end, oh, and by the way, we're going to relax the sanctions on conventional weapons as well. Look, it was obvious that John Kerry and Barack Obama wanted an agreement much worse than the Iranians wanted an agreement. And that followed throughout this agreement, in my view.
Okay, I'm going to go back and go through some of the things you said that have been discussed here in the last couple of days. James Clapper yesterday said that the United States intelligence agencies are confident that if Iran cheats on this deal, it will be detected. They have very high confidence that...
Well, let me respond to that one.
Exactly.
Okay. They had very high confidence on numerous occasions that the Iranians, that they were monitoring the Iranians, and they found out through different reasons. One of them, the facility at Fordo, was only made known to us because of Iranians in Iran that blew the whistle on them. Time after time, they have cheated, and we haven't caught them. So I'm glad that that Mr. Clapper has the that confidence. I don't see any grounds for it.
On the money, on the money. He also said that the U.S. intelligence assessment is that they will spend the lion's share of the money on fixing their economy and
I wonder why they haven't been doing that up till now.
Because they're really squeezing for money.
But that has not restrained their efforts to send weapons into and train the Houthis in Yemen. It has not restrained their efforts to send Hezbollah into Syria to prop up Bashar Assad. It hasn't restrained their efforts to fund and lead the Shia militias in Iraq. And of course, in Lebanon, they are in total control. And in the case of Yemen, they have armed and trained and equipped the Houthis as they have taken over Yemen until, of course, the Saudis decided to fight back.
So when the U.S. intelligence agencies say to you and to us here that they have complete confidence that if the Iranians cheat, we'll know it.
I can show you example after example.
No, but that's in the past. They say because of the deal.
I can show you example after example of false intelligence estimates about Iran, as well as a number of other issues.
Okay. One more thing from Clapper, because it really struck, I think, a lot of people in the room.
Yes.
When he said, okay, Iran is a state that sponsors terrorism. So you have a state sponsoring terrorism with nukes, or a state sponsoring terrorism without nukes? I'll take the latter.
That's, of course, the straw man. And by the way, I have great respect for General Clapper. I think he did a fine job. I would also point out that General Clapper and I had a knockdown, showdown fight over the issue of torture. General Clapper wanted us to practice torture. And I fought against it and finally got it in a bill prohibiting it. Just a fact I thought I'd throw in.
Well, we'll leave it out there. We'll leave it out there. Slightly changing, but staying with Iran. Do you think that this deal, assuming it does go through, tilts us in the Middle East toward Iran?
I think that the dream of Barack Obama and John Kerry is this new relationship. They keep talking about Nixon to China, which is bizarre. China had 36 Russian divisions on its border when Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger showed up in Beijing. But that's their illusion. This is that there's going to be a whole new relationship in the Middle East and Iran, and we are going to cooperate. And that's why you're seeing it scare the daylights out of the Sunni Arabs. And that's why I asked General Austin, the head of Central Command, I said, when did the Saudis tell you that they were going to launch air operations into Yemen? He said, 1 hour before. That's why one of the foreign ministers of one of the Gulf countries told me, he said, we think it's better to be America's enemy than its friend. For the first time, the Saudis went and bought $1 billion worth of weapons from Russia. They've never done that before. They are finding their own way in the Middle East because they find the United States not to be trusted.
Well, they think we're tilting. Just what I'm asking.
Yeah,
do you think
of course they think we're tilted, and we have. Just give you a great example, okay? One example. We are training, now we've trained all of 60, over 4 years, 60 Free Syrian Army people to go into Syria and fight against ISIS. They are having to swear that they will only fight against ISIS. I asked General Casey and Ash Carter in the hearing, I said, what if these young men you're training and you're sending in to Syria, what if they are attacked by Bashar Assad and barrel bombed by them? You know what the answer was? No. So we're going to tell young men to go into Syria and fight only against ISIS, even if they're attacked by Bashar Assad, who has slaughtered 230,000 of their countrymen and driven millions into refugee status. And according to the UN HCR, we now have more refugees in the world than at any time since the end of World War II.
Okay, final question on this. Do you think it is worth at least exploring, at least finding out if we can have a better relationship with Iran and if we can persuade them to work with us on some of the issues that we agree with, for example, fighting ISIS?
Well, I think we should agree to work with anybody. I'm not so much of an idealist that I won't work with anybody. But you have to show me one indication where the Iranians have drawn back or have shown cooperation or done anything that would contradict the crowds just a week or so ago that are burning American and Israeli flags and yelling, death to America, death to Israel. Their actions are what I care about. And their actions have been a steady increase in spreading terror throughout the Middle East and on occasion trying to, even in the United States, they had a plot to kill the Saudi ambassador in a restaurant in Washington. So what we need, if you want a better relation, then change your behavior. And by the way, it might be nice to release those four Americans that you are holding captive right now that Kerry said he couldn't talk about in the negotiations.
Just saying. Do you think that the president will get the votes, get the Democrats, enough of the Democrats to sustain a veto?
Not the first time. It will be the motion of disapproval will be carried. Then, of course, we have to have enough votes to override a president's veto. That will depend on 13 Democrat votes to make 67. And there are several key senators here. Senator Cardin, Senator Blumenthal, especially Senator Schumer.
They're on the fence at the moment.
That have not given their view or not arrived at a conclusion yet. Those Northeastern senators in particular, Chuck Schumer, who is the next leader of the Democrats, and by the way, a guy I enjoy doing business with, I think that's going to be a very impactful as to whether there's enough votes to override the president's veto. But I'll also tell you one other thing. They insisted on this being an agreement, not a treaty, okay? Although it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it should be called a treaty, but it's not. But it's an agreement. And the next president of the United States can cancel that agreement. You can't cancel a treaty, but you can cancel an agreement. That's an interesting scenario, depending on Iranian behavior.
Fighting ISIS. What do you think we're not doing that we can do and should do?
For openers, we have no strategy. We have no strategy. You might be interested. Some of those former military people in the room probably would tell you. 75% of the missions that are launched into Iraq and Syria return to base without dropping a weapon. Why is that? We don't have forward air controllers on the ground identifying targets. They're bombing empty buildings. They've gotten quite a few empty buildings taken out. I've got to say that for them. I can tell you from knowing these young pilots, they are so frustrated. They are so frustrated by flying a 6.5 hour flight out of off an aircraft carrier, flying around Iraq or Syria for a while, and then returning back to the aircraft carrier without doing anything. Now, this Incirlik decision is huge. It is huge, with the Turks now agreeing for us to use air power. That's a 20-minute flight into Syria from Incirlik, not a 6.5
But our guys are flying the missions.
Yes, that they have now allowed us to fly missions out of their base in Turkey, because the Syrian ISIS people and PKK are now a threat to them. So we have no strategy. We have no strategy. And I'm sorry that the administration officials who were here, I would like to have asked them, because I continue to ask them in hearings, and there's never an answer. There's never an answer. And so we don't have enough boots on the ground. We need forward air controllers. We need intelligence people. We need trainers. We need a lot of things in order to restore the hollowed out Iraqi army. And we have got to have some kind of strategy for Syria as well. My friends, we are in a long, hard struggle, and ISIS is recruiting 1,000 Europeans and from other countries every single day are flowing in, every month are flowing in to Syria and Iraq. Now, suppose that only 1% of those 1,000 every month that are flowing in are radicalized and want to go back to the country they came from and commit an act of terror. That's why the secretary. That's why the director of the FBI has said they are a direct threat.
Okay. How do you answer this, though? We get more involved when the people there are not willing to fight. You have, every opportunity to be trained. They're not stepping up. When they do fight, they run away. They drop their weapons. I mean, why should it become our fight? And didn't we learn this lesson in Vietnam?
Well, I just answered your question. The reason why it's our fight is because it's going to be a threat to the United States of America. If you think ISIS is going to confine its activities to those countries, by the way, they're spreading all over the Middle East. These young people that are being radicalized by them will be sent back. The guy that's the head of ISIS is a guy named Baghdadi. Baghdadi spent 4 years in our camp in Iraq called Camp Buka. At one time, we had 27,000 prisoners there. The day Mr. Baghdadi was released, he said to the Americans, he said, I'll see you in New York. They don't think they can take us, but they do want to attack us. We're the enemy. And we've got to beat them on the ground. Then we have to have a whole series of things like economics, like convincing the clerics, the Muslim clerics, to condemn this perverted form of Islam. We have got to build democracies. We have got nation building. We're going to be fighting this Islamic terrorism for a long, long time. But first, you have to beat them on the ground. Why do you think outfits in Africa are declaring their allegiance to ISIS? Because they see them winning. Why do you think these young people are so attracted to it? Because they see them winning. Now, I know you've had administration officials here, oh yeah, we're beating them. Really? Take a look at a map of the Middle East on January of 2009, the day of Barack Obama's inauguration, and take a look at a map of the Middle East today, my friends, and then tell me how we're doing.
I'm speechless. Lone wolves, let's bring it home for a minute. We've heard a lot at the conference, and specifically from FBI Director Comey, that we cannot break through encrypted sites on the internet. And the companies involved are not willing to open this up to the government. Is there anything that Congress can do? Is there anything you've thought about doing, proposing, or are your hands tied?
We've thought a great deal, and there's a lot of us who, frankly, are not as equipped as a lot of young people are on this new technology, which has changed the world. And I've really had to do a lot of briefing and reading and thinking and all that to try to catch up with it. Look, right now, we ought to be able to have some smart people in Silicon Valley figure out, and they can, because I think they can do most anything in the cloud, so we can break that encryption, okay? Right now, as you know, one of the proposals is that a user would have one key, that key would be used, if necessary, by the user to break the encryption, right? Our proposal is that you have two keys, one by the user and the other one kept under lock and key, which would only be used in the case of a court order, the FISA court order, if there was a need to get into that particular site. And frankly, the Google people and others are fighting very hard against that. I'm not exactly sure why. They're saying that it would compromise it and all that, yet a lot of smart young people I've talked to say that is not the case. But let me just put this in a context for you. And the reason why I was out at NSA last Friday with intensive briefings on this. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, in all areas of challenges to the United States of America, the United States has a significant advantage. He said, except in one, and that's cyber. And my friends, when you look at their ambitions, and when you look at what they may be capable of doing, then cyber has to be one of the greatest challenges that we are facing in the 21st century.
Let's do a hairpin turn and ask you about emails on Hillary Clinton's server. What are you thinking as you read this? Has she done a dastardly thing? Is this being blown out of proportion?
I think that, first of all, it was obviously a mistake to use her own server without some kind of permission or announcement and all that. But now, this latest news today that the Inspector General has found that classified information might have been in those servers, in that server, that changes everything. Because remember, the man I admire most in the world is David Petraeus. Remember what happened to him. He had given out classified information to a person who was not qualified to examine it. So if she...
Is this the same kind of thing?
Well, if she sent out emails that were secret in nature to a person who was not, did not have that clearance...
But what
then,
if she just received it, which I think...
If she just received it, then why would she receive it on a private server? That part I don't get. And who sent it? Why wouldn't that person send it on her regular official server? I happen to like Secretary Clinton. I happen to have traveled with her when we were in the Senate together. We obviously are in disagreement on a number of issues, but I think... I'm not sure how this all plays out because we've just heard the initial news. But if she received or sent classified information in an unclassified environment, that's got to have some implications.
Like a misdemeanor. That's what Petraeus got, right?
Petraeus and Sandy Berger, and there's been several. John Deutsch, several throughout the last 20 years who have been not smart.
Guantanamo, are you negotiating with the administration or at least talking to them about possibly bringing those last 60 or so prisoners back to the United States in order to close that facility?
I've always believed that Guantanamo should be closed. It is a blot on the honor of the United States of America, at least in the minds of people all over the world. Now, I will add quickly that it's not Abu Ghraib, but it has the same connotation with people all over the world. So I've always been in favor of closing it and moving those detainees to the United States of America, which is a lot more complicated than it initially appears. 6.5 years ago, Craig Craig, who was then legal counsel for President Obama, came to my office and he said, we want to close Guantanamo. I said, right, give me a plan, I'll be with you. Now 6.5 years later, I went over to meet with the president a month or almost 2 months ago. I said, give me a plan. Ash Carter and Lisa Monaco, who was here just speaking, came to my office and said, we'll give you a plan. I said, I'd like to have that plan to get it on the defense authorization bill, which we are finishing up. I still haven't heard from them. I am told that it's any minute now, checks in the mail.
I hope that they will
come up with a plan that I can sell to my colleagues. By the way, my dear friends, it costs about $2.3 million a year per inmate in Guantanamo. It costs about $70,000 a year to keep someone in a maximum security prison. So I am trying to appeal at least to my fiscal conservative friends that maybe we ought to save the taxpayers a couple of million dollars a year.
But can you bring them back to a federal penitentiary? Wouldn't you then have to charge them?
Not if the penitentiary was under the authority of the Department of Defense.
So a military brig kind of penitentiary.
A military run
not Levin, well,
prison. Well, what you could do actually to meet the letter, if not the spirit of the law, you could say this part of this maximum security prison is Department of Defense supervision and authority.
Okay. I see that the audience is dying to ask some questions, but I don't want you to think that you are going to get out of here.
We're leaving this conversation without Donald Trump.
Precisely. So I guess my first question to you about Mr. Trump is, in your mind, is he a serious, viable candidate to be president of the United States of America?
I think anybody who runs for president of the United States of America is a candidate that cannot be ignored. Do I believe that he appeals to a broad spectrum of Americans? No, I don't.
I would tell you, in your party.
Yeah, in 2007, my candidacy was declared dead. I wasn't even mentioned, and yet we were able to come back and lose in 2008. But anyway, I think that we all ought to understand here what Mr. Trump has been able to do, and that is he has been able to tap into a vein, a strong sentiment amongst many Americans that, one, that our borders are broken and that people, and that we need secure borders. My friends, I'll tell you honestly, there are ranchers in the southern part of my state that have people going across their property every night. There are guides on mountaintops in Arizona that are guiding drug smugglers and human traffickers as they go up and get to Tucson and then spread all over the country. And my constituents are mad about it. Then you have El Chapo escaping, and you have this tragic death of this woman in San Francisco, and you have a volatile mixture to which Donald Trump appeals to. And what's the approval rating of Congress, my friends? 12%? Anybody in the 12%, please raise your hand. I'd like to know where the hell you've been. By the way, my favorite line, I went through Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport, a guy runs up and says, hey, anybody ever tell you look a lot like Senator John McCain? I said, yeah, and he said, doesn't it sometimes make you mad as hell? But so Mr. Trump has tapped into a dissatisfaction amongst the American people that their government isn't working for them. So when he rants about it and says, you know, I'm going to go to Washington, I'm going to throw them all out, you know, that appeals to them. Now, do I agree with him?
Saying?
No. And do I, well, pardon me?
I said, what about the things he's been saying?
Well,
about another issue.
He has attacked everybody, literally. Perry, Bush, me, and I'm not even running.
But the one on you is the worst. The one on you is the worst.
Yeah, that's true. But look, Leslie, you know, my hero is Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt made the famous quote about the man in the arena. I'm in the arena, so I'll take it. I'll take it, and that's what it is, and it's, you know, I understand that. But the reason why I was angry, and I think so many Americans were angry, he has impugned all of those who are prisoners of war. 3 weeks ago, I had a ceremony. It was really deeply moving that the Air Force arranged. A man who was in World War II, who was shot down as a bomber pilot, spent two years in a German Stalag, was freed by Patton's Tank Corps. He's 93 years old, he's blind, and we gave him an award that he had won that he hadn't deserved. He cried. Now, I don't think that that man deserves any kind of criticism from anybody, much less Donald Trump. So that's where, in my view, that I became disturbed, not because of me, but these people who served with such great honor all this time. And could I just finally say, I don't want to dredge up the Vietnam War. When I came home from prison, there was two things that disturbed me most. One was how divisive the war had been, and two, the treatment of the Vietnam veterans. The only heroes of Vietnam in those days, my friends, were the POWs. They treated these 18 and 19-year-old kids terribly. You know that. They treated them terribly. Yep. So I wanted to unite this country and help these veterans come all the way home. And that's one reason why I embarked on this normalization of relations with Vietnam. By the way, our dearest friends now, thanks to China. But to heal those wounds. And I'm not interested in opening all that up again. It should be behind us.
Okay. Well, do you think he'll run as an independent? And if he does, isn't it over for whoever the Republican nominee would be? I mean, he would take it right out of the Republican side.
I think it'd be incredibly damaging. I can't predict exactly, but I don't think there's any doubt that if he took 10% out of a Republican vote, that would be very, very difficult to overcome. It really would. And so,
but it's, you know, possible that he'd do that.
I think it's very possible. He has hinted at it in some of his comments when he's not beating up on me or Bush or Perry or
if you were one of the 30 people up on the stage in a debate, I mean, or advise, if you were advising the people on that debate stage with him, what's the advice? Do they gang up on him?
No, the advice is answer the questions. Not so much ignore, respond if there's something like a direct attack. I mean, you don't want to totally ignore it, but get your message out. What are you for? Not just gang up, because if you gang up on Donald Trump in a debate, then obviously you're going to have sympathy for him, and that's not the object here. Just give your own message. And by the way, you've only got, with 10 candidates, divide that into an hour and a half. You've got about 5 or 6 minutes.
If Donald allows that, you know, he could eat up all the time.
So anyway.
I'm going to turn it over to questions from the audience, and I knew there'd be a lot. Let's take this one over here.
Thank you, Josh Rogan, Bloomberg View. Thank you, sir, for your time.
One of the worst journalists in Washington.
But I promised him. I promised.
I take that as a compliment. Thank you. You talked about the U.S.-Turkey agreement to increase cooperation to fight ISIS. As we all know, that's an agreement that has been negotiated for over a year. The sticking point was whether or not we would agree to a no-fly zone, call it an air exclusionary zone, call it a buffer zone. General Allen at this forum said that that was not part of the agreement. He said it wasn't even discussed. The Turkish government said that was part of the agreement and that we agreed to a buffer zone, and the details and everything was in all the Turkish newspapers. They can't both be right. Do you know what the real ground truth is here? And does it concern you that this landmark agreement to fight ISIS with Turkey, the two sides can't agree on what they agreed to?
Well, remember I was at the Iranian foreign minister that a couple of days ago said that there would be no inspections of their military facilities. John Kerry said that there would be. I believe that it's important, this Incirlik deal. But I also believe, my friends, that unless you have an aircraft exclusionary zone or a no-fly zone, whatever you call it, on the Turkish border in Syria, where you can train and equip, where you can treat people who are hospitalized, where you can get supplies and food in, then you're not going to totally succeed. But this is really big, the Incirlik deal. We'll probably get briefed. I'm sure we'll get briefed on it right after it's in the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Right here.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Trebillion. I'm one of the Aspen Scholars. Do you believe that the notion was discussed earlier today that the Middle East state system, as we know it, is sort of falling apart? What are the key national interests that you see, and who are the partners that we can rely on to secure those national interests in the Middle East?
I think a lot of it, unfortunately and unnecessarily, and it's not true historically, is now getting down to a Sunni-Shia conflict. More and more are we seeing that division in these conflicts. I also think that's overlaid by the Iranian/Persian ambitions, which are thousands of years old. One country I didn't mention today where the Iranians are putting on enormous pressure is Bahrain, small country. Why is that important? Because the Iraqi oil fields are right over the Bahraini-Saudi border. So I think it is breaking more and more into Sunni-Shia conflict. I think that ISIS is obviously more Shia. I think that ISIS is now a psychological threat, but it's the first real time that a terrorist organization has had a geographic base. And that's one reason why it is as important as it is, and the attraction that it is giving to young men and women all over the world. Which reminds me of one other issue. They're starting to see this in Indonesia as well, the world's largest Muslim country. And this infection is spreading throughout Muslim countries, and that, of course, should be very concerning to all of us. By the way, both Dunford and somebody else high ranking, both in questions in before the committee when asked what's our greatest threat, both of them said Iran. It was an interesting answer from both those military leaders.
Even ahead of
yes,
ISIS?
Yes.
Right over here.
Mark Chatterson, Macaulay Brown. Sir, for about the last few days, we talked about cybersecurity. And I believe Director Comey said that we're about 10 to 15 years behind being effective in our cyber ecosystem as we have right now. In about 5 years, we'll have 50 billion devices joining the ecosystem. There's going to be greater threat and greater vectors, et cetera. What are you doing in Congress and Senate to address it? And is there additional budgets being looked at for to deal with this problem?
The responsibility for cyber is an intelligence committee, armed services committee. It's spread out about four or five different committees when you look at areas that it attracts. There is an argument for a select committee, or at least a select commission, to be convened to get the smartest people in America together, including those from Silicon Valley, so we can figure out a way through this. Right now, it's segmented into different parts, and I'm sure that the guy sitting in the PLA office in Beijing doesn't care that much about it. They are intent on attacking. And by the way, they are becoming more and more aggressive and less concerned about whether we know that they're trying to hack or not. And my friends, just think about how much our lives are dependent on satellites. Just think how much our lives are dependent on satellites.
It would be devastating. They could knock us out big time. This is have to be the last question, right?
Could we take two more?
Okay, we'll take two more. Right here.
I'll give a short answer for a change.
Okay. Right here.
I'm Charlie Allen. I'm a member of the Chertoff Group and a old intelligence officer at CIA. Could you tell us, Senator, how the FY16 defense budget is looking up, and how is the out years looking up?
Yeah,
and will
we
have sequestration?
Could I ask you, with your experience, that you think this select committee is or commission is a good idea?
The commission?
On cyber.
Oh, I think we need something, absolutely. We need to have more momentum on cyber, and the Congress, we're looking to Congress to help. And particularly to bring the public and the private sectors together in a closer way, and that's what DHS and that's what Jay Johnson is saying he wants to do, and that's what Admiral Rogers wants.
Yeah, by the way, Homeland Security is under the Homeland Security Committee, obviously. That's another committee that has this kind of supervision. Thank you. I'll try to make it as brief as possible. There's two things I wanted to do in my life. One was to be president. We know how that turned out. The other was to be chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. We have reforms in this committee, which I won't bother you with all the details, but two of them are, one, acquisition reform. To our everlasting shame, we have cost overruns which were unconscionable, unacceptable, and disgraceful to our taxpayers of America. The latest aircraft carrier was a Gerald R. Ford. It was supposed to cost $10 billion. It's now costing $12.4 billion, and the cost is still going on. I can't go back to Arizona and justify such a thing. I asked the chief of naval operation, the head Navy guy, I said, who is responsible for this $2.4 billion cost overrun? You know what his answer was? I don't know. So part of our reform is to get the service chiefs responsible and into the game. That has been fought by the bureaucracy and the Pentagon, as you might imagine. The other one that I'd like to mention very briefly is retirement. Right now, 85% of those men and women who join the military retire without any financial benefit because you got to stay for 20 years. A commission recommended that after 2 years and 1 month, they start a 401k deal where you can contribute and that contribution will be matched, so that now 85% of those who serve in the military will receive some financial compensation whenever they decide to leave. There's many other fundamental changes we're making, and unfortunately we are still having problems between the House and the Senate conferees, the final four of us. I believe that we will be able to work it out. And finally, could I say, we enacted in 2011 a thing called sequestration. It's across the board MEDAC's cuts, which is a complete abrogation of the responsibilities of Congress. It's just across the board cuts on both domestic and defense. 13% of our spending is defense, 50% of the cuts went to defense. You saw where we just had to reduce the Army by 40,000. While the civilians and the contractors and the staffs continue to grow, the combat units continue to decline. So sequestration has got to be repealed. Otherwise, every senior uniformed officer testified before our committee. I've asked the same question. Does sequestration put the lives of the men and women who are serving in the military at greater risk? Yes, sir. We can't do that to the men and women who are serving in the military.
Woman in red, right back here. This will be the final question. I promise. Oh, it's Andrea. Andrea Mitchell. My friend.
That was the last question.
Well, give it to him, Andrea.
Thank you, Leslie. Thank you, Senator McCain. Andrea Mitchell, NBC News.
Oh, is that who you are? Oh, thank you for identifying yourself. Thank you for identifying yourself.
On the question of cyber, presumably China hacking of OPM. Wanted to follow up on that because apparently the administration has decided that it will not retaliate, that this is espionage as usual, but 22.5 million Americans have been affected, many of whom are not federal employees, are not part of the intelligence services, are just people mentioned in background checks. And General Clapper told us last night that we need to have deterrence. What is the deterrence if we're not going to retaliate at something this massive?
I'm glad you brought it up because it is really unbelievable. You will not believe this. After all these hackings and the latest one of 18 million or whatever it is, we still do not have a policy as to when there is an attack or we anticipate an attack, whether we act to prevent it or whether we try to just simply defend against it or we retaliate. There is no policy yet by the administration as to what we will do in the case of an attack. And of course, we all know that these attacks are going to continue, both in volume and sophistication. So we have urged Andrea for them to make a decision on that. They've got 30,000 people employed out at NSA. I went out there the other day. I was astounded at the size of it. And yet they still do not have specific guidelines as to how to treat cyber attacks.
Do you think this one should be retaliated against?
Oh, I absolutely do. I mean, but I also think that we ought to anticipate. We know sometimes when they're moving in or they're attempting to move in. Shut them down. This is by any definition, this is an act of war. If you go in and attack a country's economy, their way of living, if there was a bomb that goes off in acts of war, some of this hacking can be as harmful, far more harmful than a bomb going off. Now, does that mean we declare war? No, please don't get me wrong. But it is something that we should have a policy that prevents, that responds, and also is able to anticipate in the future of the anticipated attacks with the technology that our adversaries have. And by the way, I don't think it's a secret. The Russians are better at it than the Chinese are. And that's obviously very disturbing. We didn't even mention about my beloved Ukraine and the fact that they're being slaughtered and not given defensive weapons.
Can we have another hour?
It's a shameful chapter in American history, my friends. I was out in eastern Ukraine. Two of them were killed the day before I was there, a few of them after. They are being slaughtered by Russian and Russian-inspired people that are using 21st century equipment, and we won't even give them things like the javelin to defend themselves with. It's shameful. But could I just make one other additional comment real quick? I know that I've been a little bit or somewhat or very, depending on your view, unhappy, but I am overall incredibly optimistic about the future of this country. We are energy independent. That is huge. That is gigantic. We will be exporting energy. We can get oil over time and natural gas to the living rooms in Kiev. We have now manufacturing jobs in the United States that are staying in the United States and some even coming back. Third, my friends, this device is maybe made in China, but it's invented here. This is the future of the world. This is the future of the world. About a month ago, I went to Venice, California, a place I don't normally hang out in, and to speak to a group of employees at a place called Snapchat, okay? Young man, Levi's t-shirt, 25 years old, walks up to me and says, "Hey, I'm the CEO here. Thanks for coming, Senator. Talk to our employees." The guy's worth what, $2 billion? I've forgotten. Look, it is here in the United States of America where all this happens.
If it's not stolen. If it's not stolen.
But you know, even if they steal that technology, which they do, we can still look at the changes that have taken place in this. Weighs about 5 pounds now, so I am very optimistic about the future of the United States of America, because we are still the strongest, finest nation, and despite our problems with sequestration, the young men and women in uniform who are serving it, I can tell you by far are the best in the world. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Senator, I'm glad you ended on a... Senator, one second. I'm glad the Senator ended on an up note. And I think why they're all standing is because you are our hero, everybody in this room, and I mean that.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.